provide for the situation they have maybe encountered. And of course, they will also assist us on some recommendations so that when discussing this, then it will be easier for us to deal with. But we are saying that while South Africans are celebrating, and I must say the hearings aim at bringing different stakeholders a platform to engage in, on issues around this discrimination and the existing measures or measures that are in place to curb this discrimination in the workplace. And of course, the hearings anticipate a rigorous engagement among stakeholders where thoroughly analysis and consultation will take place in order to produce a detailed report, which will then include those recommendations. And we this morning also have the department just to give a remark on what we are doing. We know that there will be a presentation on employment equity. The commissioner will be the chairperson of the commission, will be also presenting, not today of course, but today we have some colleagues from the department. And of course, the representation from the department will be there in all the public hearings. But without wasting any more time, we are saying welcome to this morning, especially yourself, Dr. Steyman, and the others, those who will be presenting today. But let me give to Mr. Mkhadipi, and then I will introduce our first presenter. Mr. Mkhadipi.
Thank you, my chair and members of parliament. As the chair has already indicated, that the department will do a presentation tomorrow to the Commission for Employment Equity. But as a department, we think this process is very important for us, and it's going to assist in the implementation of our legislation, especially the Employment Equity Act. As we all know, that we have not made a lot of movement in that direction in the 8 years of the existence of the Act. We waiting with interest the kind of recommendation that the stakeholders who are supposed to implement the Act are going to come up with, especially labor and business, in the improvement in the implementation of the Act. I think, Chair, for us as a department, as I've said, we think this is long overdue. We should have had this discussion with the stakeholders long time ago, and we appreciate the platform set by Parliament for us to be able to interact. As I've said, our contribution is tomorrow. The Commission chairperson will be making a contribution around the implementation of Employment Equity Act and its attempts in dealing with racism in the workplace. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Let me give Dr. Steyman from Workplace Dignity Institute. Dr. Steyman, welcome for coming, and could you just explain yourself, who you are and what are you doing? And of course, you are given until 10 to 11. According to the program, yes. Yeah, but we'll see. But you will just tell us who you are. Over to you, madam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and the Parliament for giving us the opportunity to be here in Cape Town and to share ideas from you from the Workplace Dignity Institute. And also thank you for the wonderful arrangements to be here. We appreciate it, and we hope that our contribution will be taken seriously, because it's from many years of experience, and we love to share this with you. The Workplace Dignity Institute was founded in 2005. Before that, we were the Work Trauma Foundation. In 2002, I received an Ashoka Fellowship to pioneer workplace bullying and workplace violence in South Africa. And our activity centered around advocacy, research conferences, programs to address workplace violence. We did some international research with the International Labour Organization, the International Council of Nurses, World Health Organization, and Public Services International in 2001-2002, which resulted in a report on workplace violence in the health sector of South Africa. We also rolled out a program on behalf of the ILO, ICN, WHO, PSI in 2005. We celebrated the National Dignity Week. We just made our own from the Workplace Dignity Institute. And we rolled out this program to prevent workplace violence, physical and emotional violence, with wonderful outcomes. And currently, I've been appointed as the ILO ICN WHO PSI National Facilitator for Workplace Violence Programs, for their workplace violence programs in South Africa. Now, I will talk a little bit about the program later on, but this is basically my background. We've been active. I've been active in this field since 1994. In 1997, the previous Minister of Labour, Mr. Tito Mboweni, launched the first book on the topic of victimization called Corporate Hyenas at Work. And since that time, we've pulled seriously and looked into workplace violence as a serious and a lethal threat to employers. And in compiling this code of conduct, we hope to prevent workplace violence, because from my experience when I did the pilot project with Housing Health Department, I know that violence can be prevented in the workplace. It's not an animal, it's not too big to tackle, but once we can tackle it, we can have the results of a more productive workplace. So workplace violence, and workplace violence is defined as a single or cumulative incident where employees are physically assaulted or attacked, or emotionally abused, pressurized, harassed, or threatened overtly, covertly, directly, or indirectly in work-related circumstances with a likelihood of impacting on their right to dignity, physical or emotional safety, well-being, work performance, or social development. Quite a mouthful, but at the time, and I want to tell you the history of this definition, it was negotiated basically with the health sector unions and the CCMA since 2002. And 2007, we had the last input to refine this definition so that it can be inclusive of physical and emotional violence in the workplace. This is the best we could come up with, and I hope that it explains the phenomenon of workplace violence. Because it is not only...
There's something wrong with the mic.
Sorry. Probably I'm touching here on the... my apologies. So it's not only physical violence in the workplace, but it's also the emotional violence, the psychological violence, which is the intentional use of power, including threat or physical force against another person or group, that can result in harm to family life, livelihood, physical, mental, spiritual, moral, or social development. These are all the definitions used by the ILO, ICN, WHO, PSI Joint Program on Workplace Violence, it is used worldwide. I just use these definitions because I think they describe the phenomenon better. And we can see the rest of these definitions on page 7. If we turn to page 7 of this document, the Code of Good Conduct, the definition is that emotional abuse is inclusive of abuse, and that would normally include verbal abuse that humiliates, degrades, or otherwise indicates a lack of respect for the dignity and worth of the individual. Bullying and mobbing, which is a serious problem worldwide. There's a new focus on this problem of bullying and mobbing in the workplace. It is repeated and over time offensive behavior through vindictive and cruel or malicious attempts to humiliate a person. I'm not going to read all the definitions for you. Harassment, sexual harassment, and racial harassment also forms part of workplace violence. And this is the tendency worldwide to cluster workplace violence into physical and emotional violence, and looking at racial harassment, threats, everything is in one. And then we're also looking at structural violence. This is a difficult one, because structural violence is more systemic violence. And we can talk about, look at overload. Now, recently I've done research for a university among university staff members where there is a lot of overload. And there's a correlation between workplace bullying and workplace overload, a very high correlation. So when we have structural violence where the system is violent and abuses employees or is overloaded and knowingly or unwittingly perhaps is abusing employees, we also get workplace violence. And it is includes but not limited to the disrespectful handling of changes in the organization, unrealistic distribution of workloads, intimidation, and that doesn't mean that we often have work overload. I don't think that intimidation, policies, procedures, regulations, manipulation, coercion to act in a certain way, and so on, exercised by an individual or the entity. So if we look at these, the psychological violence, and also the terminology of a victim, a perpetrator, and work trauma is the result of workplace violence. Usually it is post-traumatic stress syndrome when people are emotionally abused, and your dilemma is we have constitutional provisions. I want to refer you to the first page of the Code of Conduct here, Section 9.1, Section 10. Everyone has the inherent dignity and the right to have his dignity or her dignity respected and protected. Section 12.1c, the right to freedom and security. Section 23.1 and Section 24. So all these refer directly or indirectly to workplace violence. Workplace violence affects the dignity of the employees. And all professions are at risk, whether you are a politician or whether you are in lower down the hierarchy, it doesn't matter. Our dignity can be affected. We're all at risk. It depends very much also on the whether we're female. Females are, research proves that females are at a much higher risk of workplace dignity than your male employees. And professions like public service, your nursing, your health professions, your prisons or correctional services, they are all at high risk. And the public sector is generally at a higher risk than the private sector. Workplace violence at the moment is better managed in the private sector than in the public sector, basically because the private sector have a choice of clientele, whereas, for instance, in the case of healthcare, you do not have that choice of clientele. Always everybody's got to be served, irrespective of whether they are criminals, or whatever happens, that is their right to be treated with dignity and respect by the healthcare workers, but it puts them at risk. So we have in the public sector a much higher risk of workplace violence. This impacts on service delivery tremendously. I cannot emphasize enough how this impacts on the service delivery in the healthcare sector. We need to address workplace violence very seriously. The health and well-being of the employees, because absenteeism is rising. You pay so much more to have people retrained and they're leaving the profession when there's too much violence, and the financial implications for the enterprise. And South Africa is not unique in this problem of workplace violence. In fact, this is part of a worldwide phenomenon, and everywhere, all over the world, this has become a focal point of attention, and people are putting legislation in place or codes of conduct in place. Now, legislation addressing emotional abuse in the workplace is already in place in Canada. They've got the Moral Harassment Act. 13 states in the USA already adopted the Healthy Workplaces Bill, which prohibits workplace violence. France has adopted the Moral Harassment Act. Germany, the UK and Australia use the OHS Act, and the European Union adopted a code on workplace bullying and violence. And Sweden and Norway has legislation in place since the 1990s. So we can see that all over the world there is a new interest in this. In the USA, the research indicates that 37% of workers are bullied. My recent research at the South African University indicated that 25% of the staff are bullied. These figures may vary from institution and the type of services they deliver, and as also the sector and enterprise they are in. The extent, and I just want to show the extent of workplace violence in South Africa. This is my 2002 research figures. Physical violence in the public sector, and this is in the health sector, and this study is the ILO-ICNWHO-PSI study, is 17%. It's extremely high, and 9.1% in the private sector. Bullying and mobbing, 24.4%, while it's 16.3% in the private sector. So my earlier reference is that in all sectors and in all countries, not only South Africa, we have this problem in the public sector. Verbal abuse, 60.1 and 42.8. Racial harassment, 27.1 in the public sector and 17.4 in the private sector. And sexual harassment is more or less the same. So we can see that this problem is serious. It needs to be addressed in all sectors, and we need to make the public aware that there is something like dignity. It's also, Madam Chair, my opinion that if we can succeed in introducing dignity in the workplace, in combating violence in the workplace, it will spill over to society and have a beneficial effect, because that is the place where there are the structures, the money, the expertise, the knowledge, the professionalism to actually drive these programs also into the community. And after all, when we talk about fighting violence in the workplace, we're talking about introducing dignity and respect as a new culture. And that is why I'm very excited that if we can address it on this level, it will be beneficial to society. The impact of workplace violence is the physical abuse is easily recognizable. We see there's a scar, we can put on a plaster, we can take care of that person. When there is emotional abuse, it's far more difficult. If there's racial harassment, sexual harassment, and so on, it's difficult to prove in the first place, and in the second place, it leaves invisible scars on the people who are hurt by emotional abuse. Post-traumatic stress syndrome is a typical reaction with devastating results on the physical, the emotional well-being, and the career development of the person. And research indicates that few employers have policies in place. But in my research, I discovered that when employers actually have policies in place, the frequency is reduced by 75%. From it happening all the time, it is reduced to happening sometimes. It still occurs. Workplace violence is something that the fight never stops, but the frequency can be reduced. And that is one of the miracles of this program that the ILO introduced. the code to deal and prevent with workplace violence will fill the gaps not addressed by the other codes. Also, when we talk about discrimination, it is a little bit of this and that, and I think that this workplace violence code tells us everything that workplace violence is. We do have a sexual harassment code, and that is perfect. And it doesn't need to be scrapped or anything. It just needs to be recognized, but that all the types of violence can be recognized. South Africa has a proud record of leading as a leading country in terms of labor legislation. And whenever I am in Geneva or Torino with the ILO, it is South Africa in glowing terms they do refer to us. Worldwide, the focus is at present on workplace violence, and particularly emotional abuse in the workplace. And the foundation has been laid in our legislation for a free and fair society, and the logical next step would be to broaden the existing code and to include a code on workplace violence. The development of employee wellness practices and sections in human resources, and also the World Health Organization's drive for healthy workplaces, is gaining momentum worldwide. The prevention and the management of workplace violence and this code should be managed through, and this is my suggestion, and I found it in practice working very well, by employee wellness, human resources, employee wellness sections of workplaces to yield optimum results in the workplace, together with your HIV/AIDS program. Because if we look at workplace violence and we see discrimination against people that are HIV positive, bullying, for instance, would fit in there. So that if you address one psychosocial problem, they tend to cluster. And that is why in workplace violence, we need to recognize this cluster effect of workplace violence with HIV/AIDS, with stress, with substance abuse in the workplace, and recognize these as being one of the same thing. The service charter attached to this for the victims of workplace violence is similar to the service charter the SAPS uses for victims, the service charter for victims. It's very much written along the same lines, but just to suit the workplace. And it clearly states also there it is obvious that you need an EAP, section assistance program, where there's counseling services, but also information available. The code includes, and I just want to go through this, formal and informal procedures on page 11. And I just want to make one correction. I see on page 11, dispute resolution, the matter to the Public Health Bargaining Council. I'm sorry, this was for the health sector and this paragraph slipped in. It is for the bargaining council, the CCMA, or arbitrator. We're using our formal and informal procedures, which could be facilitated. And in a code, I think a code is just better. People may differ with me, but a code can be better as legislation, because it can be more effective. And we need to look at formal procedures, investigations, and the code goes on investigating and disciplinary action. We also look at the sexual harassment code that we don't introduce something stranger that is not within our legal framework, criminal and civil charges, dispute resolution, and the most important thing on page 12 would also be monitoring and evaluation. The code is not focused on punitive action, but rather a way in which workplaces can be more productive, because there is a wealth of research that will indicate that workplace physical and emotional violence is so counterproductive in the workplace. And the interventions are not just on the individual level, it's on organizational and systemic levels of simple things like better security at, for instance, institutions to prevent violence from happening, from screening people for dangerous weapons, from just having a code for dignity and respect in the workplace, and just for making us aware of the fact that people can be abused emotionally too. So this is not punitive action, but rather the way in which workplaces could be more productive and where workers can thrive in a pleasant atmosphere. A workplace program to prevent workplace violence makes a huge difference. I referred to the ILO, ICN, WHO, PSI joint program on workplace violence, who developed a program, and the program is called VETO. It means against, the V for violence at work and educational, the E, training operational toolkit, and it means stop violence. And it addresses the problem on a systemic level, on an awareness level of connecting with the role players, and that is how we did it in the health department. We brought in the trade unions, and they brought into this program, and they actually monitored the program. And with their cooperation, we had magnificent outcomes. So this program is very inclusive, and I would recommend that this program be used right throughout South Africa. It is there, and it can be used with wonderful results. And it could be more productive where workers can thrive in a pleasant atmosphere. It had a profound impact on the level of empowerment of the workers to deal with their own problems, but also to make people take responsibility for workplace violence, not expect management to do everything, but it's driven bottom up. And people themselves are taking responsible and making a difference. And the victim charter, which is attached as an extra A to the code, emphasizes the need for a victim-centered approach, which is very, very important when we're dealing with victims, and recognizes the impact of the on the victim's health and well-being. This is a very important aspect of dealing with workplace violence. Madam Chair, I didn't want to go through the whole presentation, the 12 pages with you, because I think that we can talk to it. Everybody had access to the document before the time, and instead of just repeating everything, you are welcome to ask me questions about the presentation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That was Dr. Steinman. She has given us another part of workplace discrimination. But members, we are going to take another presentation, then we will be having some questions of clarity. But I want to remind members and our presenters that we were prompted by the report from the Employment Equity Commission that has shown us really that there are areas that has to be looked at. So I think the next presenter will be giving us a picture about what is within the Commission on Employment Equity. So I'm not going to waste any more time, but to give to Mrs. Kezia Lewins. You will also do the same. Kezia, tell us who you are, where you come from. Over to you, Bebe.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairperson. Can everyone hear me okay? It's on. Okay. Thank you very much for the opportunity for us to come and speak. Thank you to the fellow presenters and everyone else who's come to make this event very meaningful, and I'm sure you'll have great deliberations. I'm Kezia Lewins. I'm from the University of Witwatersrand. I'm a lecturer in the Sociology Department, and I work with the Sociology of Work Unit, whom some of you may know Professor Webster and Professor Bushungu, who do a lot of work with the Department of Labor. SWAP does a lot of issues, as they're mainly an industrial sociology unit, do a lot of work with the ILO as well, the Department of Labor. And in fact, what we're doing at the moment is we have a big project on employment equity that, that you've commissioned us to do, looking at the impact and implementation of employment equity. The sectors that we're busy looking at the moment are platinum mining, electrical goods in terms of manufacturing, and higher education. So we're still very much in the early phase of this research, but I'd like to talk a little bit today about some of the findings, engaged with data that comes from the Department of Labor itself and also from the Employment Equity Commission, and if we have time, look at a case study of higher education. Let me just get this. Sorry. Okay, so as I said, part of what we'd like to do today is to just highlight some of the complexity of employment equity in practice and maybe give you some things to deliberate around. Okay, some of the issues that I'd like to address in this presentation today is firstly to talk about the complexity of labour markets themselves. We tend to engage with the labour market as a unified market, when in fact it's quite complicated, being segmented, and through the history of South Africa, we find that our labour markets are segmented along the lines of race, gender, class, and even geography to a certain extent. And of course, labour markets are also stratified because all the different main industrial sectors that we have in the country have different requirements, different needs, different challenges within them, and so that's one of the things we want to look at. The second point I'd like to look at is to talk about employment equity throughout the entire labour market. What we tend to find is that often we get a little bit preoccupied with employment equity in the top end positions, so from professionals and managers, and we tend to forget about those in the middle of the labour market and towards the lower end of the labour market, so we'd like to reintroduce some of those issues as well. Another thing that will very much come out of our case study on higher education is to look at what we're talking about, competing equities. As we all know, we have multiple forms of equity, race, gender, disability, HIV, AIDS status coming through as well. And what we'd like to motivate for is for us to look and see, do these different types of equities facilitate transformation broadly, or do they sometimes compete and trade off? And then leading out of all of that, what we'd like us to look at is say, today, almost 10 years after the implementation of employment equity, we've had a general policy. It has done some great things, and it's definitely been necessary to get us to where we are today, but we'd like to motivate for perhaps more rigorous thinking around specific policy that's maybe sector-specific and that takes specific specific issues in terms of race, gender, and how those relate together. Okay, so that's just the main issues that I hope will come out of the presentation. Okay, I think I'm a very different sort of academic discipline to Sue, in terms of that we're very much located in terms of industrial sociology, so you'll see a lot of the things that I talk about are very much around of workplace labour issues in the traditional limited strict sense. So what we try to do with employment equity is to transform what we call the apartheid workplace regime. And as you'll see from the key figures of that workplace regime that we had during apartheid was a racial division of labour, racial structure of power, segregation of facilities, obviously the migrant labour system, and a bifurcated industrial geography. So some of the things that the Employment Equity Act tries to do is to undo this and to make things more equitable and to transform race and gender relations in particular. Okay, sorry, I'm just going to go back a second. Just so you know, for my discussion, I'm just going to be talking about race and gender equity. So forgive the limitation for not including disability and HIV and AIDS, but for time I thought two would be more manageable. Okay, if we look at the Employment Equity Commission and the data that the Department of Labor gathers, what we'll see countries, we still very much have a racialized and hierarchical labor market. Just to give you some quick statistics, if we look at the agriculture sector, we find that 92.9% of that sector is black, and obviously those are low-end jobs, seasonal jobs, very, very insecure jobs. And the same with construction, which we can compare on the opposite end to electricity, gas, and water supply, which again links into municipalities, so it's useful, which is 77% black. So again, more white people in that industry. And in terms of women, mining and quarrying, very interesting, being on the very low end, 3.8% women only. Again, why we're talking about the importance of sectoral investigation is because whilst we do want, say, for example, mining to be more equitable, it's very unlikely that it will be as equitable as other sectors, so perhaps we need to think around through issues like that. And then, of course, on the other hand, we have things like community, social, and personal services, 53.9% female, so a lot more gendered in terms of in favor of women, and that, of course, includes many of the education and health sectors. Okay, I've just put this table up here just to give you a brief idea. One of the things that the Employment Equity Commission doesn't do in its report is to break down the statistics per sector. So I went back to the labor force survey to draw out this data. And you can very much see from that in terms of most of the sectors are dominated by black people, but of course we have to ask at what level are they employed. And particularly we notice things that in the finance section that is particularly still dominated by white people and men in particular. My presentation is, I'm afraid, very, very statistical, so I hope I don't send you to sleep, but if you do have my presentation, all the tables are in there, so it might be a bit easier to follow. So one of the things that we're suggesting by saying the importance of a stratified labor market is looking at each of these different sectors. And here I've just selected the main five sectors that employ the most amount of people. And so we might want to look at each of these sectors in particular and see what are the constraints, what are the challenges within each of them, and perhaps think about would we want to develop some kind of quota system or just to acknowledge the different needs that we have in these sectors. So I'm just going to go through this quite quickly. The second one then is more of the focus of what the Employment Equity Commission focuses on, looking mainly at occupational level. And as you'll see, again, you can see the racialized and gendered hierarchy here, particularly with African people in particular being clustered right down low the elementary occupations and plant and machine operators. And again, white people more located towards the higher end. What's very interesting here is that in terms of professionals, there is a gap. And when we look at the progress over the last 5 years, we'll very much see how, in some way, there's trade-offs between these different levels, and maybe give us some impetus to think about how we can move forward and think about developing equity amongst all of these categories. I think the next... Okay, right. I'm not sure how well you can see this. Sorry, it did come better at my home computer. What I have in this table here is, I'm sure we all know the expression of glass ceilings, a glass layer above which certain categories of people cannot go and sort of can see above and hit their heads but can't get there. What I couldn't find in the literature was the opposite, so I've coined this rather silly, but I hope you'll forgive me, phrase of stone floors, which are the opposite. It's a stone floor below which certain people don't know. So what, if you see here, all of the X's in this table refer to sectors in which the economic threshold, so for example, what I did is to look at the the percentages of economic activity per race and gender, and then I've put X's where the percentage of people in those categories match that. Sorry, I'm not making much sense. So if you see the blue X's, what that means is all of those, people, so there we have African men, African women, all African people basically, coloured men, and coloured people in general, as well as black men, black female in total, all under a glass floor. So the top X, which is generally along the line of service worker or clerks, is the glass ceiling, which above that, the percentage of black women, coloured women, are below the economic activity threshold. And if we look at Indian and white people, we'll see they're above the stone floor, and that is that most of their workers are located from legislators all the way down to service workers and not in the bottom sector. So I think this is quite a useful diagram just in terms of showing us where different people are getting in the labour market and where we still have some of the gaps in terms of occupation. Here, and there will be time for questions at the end, but if anything isn't clear, please do ask as we go through. Okay, if we look at change in the top three sectors, which as I said tends to be where most of the focus is on employment equity, if we look at management, what we will see there is that African men and white women, obviously white men have been excluded from this diagram, but in terms of employment equity beneficiaries, these two categories of people are the most numerous in the labour market. Over the last 5 years, however, what you will notice is that African women, coloured women, Indian women and white women have increased at a rate faster than their male counterparts in all categories. And of course, what you'll see in the 2006, the right at the back, there's been a huge increase in white women in the last year. And again, the committee might want to look into what are particular reasons for that. Okay, the same if we look at senior management, we find quite similar statistics, although there's more equal increase over the 5 years across all groups. However, again, as you'll see, white women has increased, and I'm sure there'll be some debate tomorrow about employment equity beneficiaries and whether it's time to phase out certain beneficiaries, like perhaps white women in these instances. So I'll flag that, but I'm sure it'll be picked up tomorrow. Okay, the one sector that I think has potentially quite a few problems is the sector of professionally qualified people. And what you see is over the 5 years, it's been very, very uneven across all categories. Every single category there have been increases, decreases. And what we notice here particularly is there's a large drop-off in terms of African men and African women. So we really need to ask what's happening here. And I think it's something that needs to be further investigated, but perhaps part of it might be that the African men and African women who were in this sector in the 2000s may have moved upward. So they might actually be upwardly mobile, not a brain drain and having gone elsewhere. But of course, what we have to ask is why have these people not been replaced? Is it something to do with the educational system? Is it something to do with the institutional culture and professions? Is it just that the middle upper class for black people is moving higher, and so these people are moving out? So there's a lot of questions there. And of course, as you'll see from this diagram too, again, particularly in 2006, a large increase in white women, but I've put white men on here as well because it's the only sector at the top where in the last year there's been a large increase in white men as well. So of course, for the productivity of the sector, the long-term transformation issues, this is a particular sector that you might want to look at in a lot more depth. And what I want to do now, okay, no, not yet, sorry. Another exercise that I thought would be useful to do is to say, if we look at the labour market as a whole, and you might want to, before looking here, just have a quick look at the at figure 13 on page 9. And what I have there is the labour market itself. So I looked into what percentage of the labour market in entirety are skilled workers, unskilled, semi-skilled, managers, professionals, etc. And then I compared each of the gender and racial groups with that to see how we're doing. So what you'll notice from this diagram here is, I'm not sure if everyone can see, but it's African men, coloured men, Indian men, and white men. And what you can see is in terms of African and coloured men, the large percentage of people are either unskilled or semi-skilled. Whereas compared to Indian and white men, people are more semi-skilled, skilled through to the professions, and of course management starts to increase there. So if we want to think make linkages to skills development, which is, I know, one of your objectives, then we might want to also look at each of the racial categories and the types of skills that people have and think about how we can link that to equity. Okay, very similar. If we look at women, we see very, very much the same pattern that African and coloured women, the majority is either unskilled or semi-skilled compared to white women and Indian women who are skilled and more towards the professions. I just want to say a few interesting things here. What this suggests to us is that obviously very much the racial hierarchy and the racial division of labour still continues to exist, but what's important to note is there is some gender does also play a role in this, because you'll notice in all of the categories, and I'm sure you'll notice in more detail in the paper rather than a quick presentation, but the change that we do notice is when we look at the senior levels, we find that Indian men, in terms of professions and management, are doing better. There are more of them rather than white women when we look at each percentage category. And so this is interesting because it shows how gender starts to shape, even with white women who are doing very, very well in the labour market. The gender role still comes in there. Okay, I hope I'm not going too far. What I want to do, so lastly now, is to look at the case study of higher education. Now, higher education is fascinating for several reasons. First of all, it's the training ground for skilled people and professionals in particular, and we said that we seem to have something going on in the profession. It's also very, very interesting because the Department of Education has, through its HEMIS database, been tracking employment statistics in higher education for 20 years. So we have a 20-year overview, and we can have a longer view at what's been going on in that labour market than just the 8 years since the implementation of employment equity. So if you look at these diagrams here, you can see, first of all, it's a pretty small labour market. There's only 12,000 permanent academic staff in the whole country, which proportionally is quite small. What you'll also notice is that change has been happening quite a lot since the 80s, and particularly what we're concerned about is from the 2000 to 2004, there's actually a bit of a stagnation of that labour market, and then you can see 2004 there's an increase of everybody, white and black people. Again, if you look at the second graph there, it shows that since 1994, the greatest increase in academics has been in terms of African people. So there is some transformation going there. Just so you've got some idea that it is considered quite a slow transformation, because in 1986, 90% of the academic labour market were white people, and in 2005, it was 65%. So it's still quite slow change. One of the interesting things I did for you, I just want to quickly find it. It's in the paper. So what I did is I looked at what has been the rate of racial transformation before the Employment Equity Act and after the Employment Equity Act. And what we noticed, and obviously this is an average over the years, but before the implementation of the Employment Equity Act, it was 1.3%, an increase of 1.3% black academics per year, and after the Employment Equity Act, it's been 1.6%. So it is an increase, but is it as much of an increase as we want? And given the changes that are happening around the rest of the labour market, it seems quite low and quite problematic. Of course, one of the problems with the academic labour market is because it's the training ground for professions, the professional market outside of academia is much more alluring than that within. So there's lots of issues there in terms of salaries as well. If we look at gender, again, what we'll notice is that universities are much further along the road in terms of gender transformation than in terms of race. However, again, if we look at this, so what we find today is the academic labour market itself is about 40% women. And again, if we do the statistics for before and after Employment Equity Act, what we find is before Employment Equity Act, it was a rate of 0.83%, so much lower than the racial transformation, and after employment, 0.86% a year, and after employment equity a drop to 0.83%. So that's something interesting going on there. There's actually a decline. And if we look at specific universities and specific labour markets, what we noticed is, again, from 2000, there is a stagnation across most universities. And unfortunately, the statistics, the racial category that's dropping the most is African women. So again, we need to see what's happening in our universities. This next table here was just very quickly just to show you the age dynamics of universities. And what we find is most of the labour market is between the ages of 35 and 54, but the only two categories that have increased in the last few years are the above 55 and the above 65, and the under 35 has actually been dropping. So again, we have to, are we getting new younger people into the universities? And again, when we look at productivity in terms of journal article writing, we find that it's those older tend to be the older white men who are the most productive in terms of research productivity. And again, it's interesting linking to your presentation in terms of workload. We all know that universities in the last 20 years have gone through a process of massification, and teaching loads have gone up, and the implications that that has as well. Okay, one of the last slides I have is just to break down the gender and race-based equity for each university, so that you can have some idea of how university is going, and as I say, that's in the paper for close inspection later. But what we tend to notice is there's still very much the historic legacy of institutional type is still very, very much there today. In terms of historically advantaged universities are from about, well, from on the low end, from 12% to 25% black, and historically disadvantaged universities on the other side, with gender being the most extreme at 90% black. When you look at gender, you'll see it's a much, much closer labour market, relatively more statistical equality anyway, let's put it that way. But it is also important to look at particular universities and see what's going on. For example, if we look at historically advantaged universities and we look at CERTS, CERTS employed its first black academic in the 1940s, and today still only has 25% of its academic labour force who are black, whereas if we look at, University of Free State, then we had the first black academic in the 1980s, and already there is 16% black. So again, we have to look at what's going on, you know, where is change happening, and perhaps interrogate universities' commitment to transformation. And so when we look at most institutions and the institutions as a whole, we definitely notice that from 2000 there's a drop-off in the rate of all types of equity at universities. So we have to ask what's happening now. Obviously, the first couple of years there was an aggressive implementation. Okay, so to bring this all together, just to summarize the case study, I think I've answered that. But just quickly, if you go back and look at those statistics, what you'll see is very, very few universities managed to do both, have managed to transform their racial categorizations and also gender. Few of them have managed, but often it seems a trade-off, so we need to look at how universities and perhaps institutions as a whole are. So my conclusion then was, I hope it hasn't been too fragmented. But basically, to think about employment equity as part of the general labour process and our labour strategy, although even my presentation is focused on the top level of the labour market, but also to think about what's going on in the middle level and the lower level, and particularly where we have retrenchments and restructuring in sectors such as agriculture, retail, those kind of sectors, and huge insecurity around those types of work as well, and to see see that most of that work is done by African men and women, and not only to see employment equity about rectifying the statistics in the top half, but think about the legacy of apartheid on those in the lower ends of the labour market, and particularly perhaps about how we can introduce an element of class into equity as well. And obviously to take cognizance that there are multiple labour markets, not just one, and perhaps when we're looking at sectors to try and see what are the different needs and requirements and the different constraints that different sectors face, and not just say that everybody at this level, this should be the statistics, but what are the requirements of these particular sectors. Again, to think about, are equities competing, and what are the ways in which we can try to overcome that so that equities facilitate each other. I've just talked about statistics today, but I hope that other people will talk about more substantive change, in terms of change that's not just changing who you have in your organization, but their kind of experiences, the access they have to resources, their upliftment as well. And also just to re-emphasize the importance of education and training. Just the last point I want to make is our preliminary research shows that most of the training that's happening within sectors, within the labor market provided by the teachers, is still being done by the people who are in the workplace. So if we look at those statistics and we see the top end is dominated by white people and white men, and the lower end is dominated by African men and women, that's where the training is happening. And it's obviously difficult for people to move up if they don't have the skills, and if the skills are located in the workplace training, you know, unless you have some kind of progressive training in place, it's very difficult for people to move out of where they are. So, yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Tanzia. This is Tanzia from the Sociology of Work Unit at the University of Witwatersrand, who have been commissioned by the Department of Labor to do study on employment equity. We thank you very much, and those were the two presentations for today. But before breaking for tea, maybe to take you through the progress, because Assistant Secretary is going to produce the program for tomorrow. As I've said, we have quite a number of submissions, but today we wanted to take two, because the majority of the submissions were from individuals. And we then said, for today, let's take two presentations for some of the individuals. And of course, we could not do otherwise, because many people who requested to present came up with suggested dates for that will be suitable for them. So we have first taken those dates, put them on their dates they wanted, and then of course we'll see how it goes. So tomorrow that will be the two, and tomorrow it will be the presentation coming from Commission on Employment Equity, and then also presentation from the Management Forum, and also the Commission on Gender Equity. That will be tomorrow. Next week, Tuesday, will be presentation by Human Rights Commission, also by Business Unity of South Africa, BUSA, and by Women's Paralegal Center. Then the last day, which will be the 12th, will be presentation by the Department of Public Service and Administration, who will be giving us a picture about how far is the government, is there compliance around this area. Also presentation by Solidarity and presentation by COSATU. We are going to be looking at some submissions, because there are so many who want to do the oral submission. And COSATU also wanted us to take their affiliates. But because of time, you know very well that we are giving only the morning of these presentations. But we want to thank you, the two of you. Thank you very much, Kezia. You have touched the area of transforming the apartheid workplace regime, reminding us on what we noted, that prior 1990, the South African labor market was characterized by a number of distortions, inefficiencies, high levels of exploitation, and the legal framework there by then ensured that black people, women, people with disabilities were available as cheap labor and restricted to the unskilled and semi-skilled sectors of labor market that you have touched on. Now, today, the democratic government has, since 1994, enacted progressive legislation intended to transform the labor market and begin to restore the dignity of poor people and vulnerable people. So you have given us a little bit of picture, and of course to see how it goes. And I think in your response you will also be assisting us on what will be the recommendations thereof. But members, I think we should, because it's only 10-2 or nearly 10-2, we were going to break at 5-2, but I think we should break for tea, then from there we will have a discussion or engagement to our presenters.